Now, chapter 19, he talks about the burden of Egypt. So he's giving you all these countries in the Middle East, one after the other, and telling you what's going to happen to them between now and then after Christ comes back. Behold, the Eternal rides on the swift cloud, and he's going to come into Egypt. Now, he hadn't done that before. And when the Eternal rides on the swift cloud, and we're going to be riding along the clouds with him, regathering Israel as scattered, and putting down these nations that are trying to destroy man, the idols of Egypt are going to be moved at his presence. And the heart of Egypt is going to melt in the midst of it. So finally, all of their pagan practices are going to be abolished, and I'll set the Egyptians against the Egyptians. And that's not too hard to do when they're Arabs. But that's happened, you know. Arabs against Arabs, and fighting among themselves, and bickering, and they're going to fight everyone against his brother and everyone against his neighbor, city against city, kingdom against kingdom of Arabs. And the spirit of Egypt is going to fail in the middle thereof, and God's going to destroy the counsel thereof, anybody that gives them counsel. They're going to seek to the idols and charmers and familiar spirits and wizards. And the Egyptians, God said, I'm going to give over into the hand of a cruel lord and a fierce king. And we already know who that is from Daniel 11. King of the south pushes at the king of the north, and the king of the north comes on him like a whirlwind. So now God describes that beast power and their beast leader, and he calls him a fierce king. So whoever's over the 10 nations of Europe at the end time, you've got one of the descriptions of him right there. A fierce king, ruling over the Egyptians, says the Lord, the Eternal Host. The water shall fail from the sea, and the river shall be wasted and dried up. Is that going to be drought through military devastation and desolation? Well, apparently the rivers are going to be stinking because of death. They'll turn the rivers far away. In other words, the rivers are so full of stench from the death that's there that they'll deter them out away from their land so the stink won't be there. The books of defense will be emptied and dried up. The reeds and flags will wither. The paper reeds by the brooks, by the mouth of the brooks. Everything sown by the brooks will wither, driven away. And if you've ever been to Egypt, that's really well described there. The fishers shall mourn. All they that cast angle into the brooks shall lament because there's death in the waters. No more even pure enough for animal or fish to live in. They that spread nets on the waters shall languish. Moreover, they that work in fine flax and they that weave network shall be confounded. They shall be broken in the purposes thereof. All that make sluices and ponds for fish. Surely the princes of Zoan are fools. The counsels of the wise counselors of Pharaoh is become brutish. So now he's just giving you some of the chief families among the Egyptians there, that they're counseling together among themselves as to what to do. And the dumb counsel they get is, well, just shut off the oil from those Europeans. That'll teach them. Well, boy, that's bad counsel. As he comes roaring down there like a whirlwind. So the wise counselors of Pharaoh are going to become like animals in their heads of thinking, dumb counsel. How do you say to the Pharaoh, I'm the son of the wise, the son of ancient kings? Where are they? Where are they, your wise men? Let them tell you now. Let them know what the Eternal Host has purposed on Egypt. The princes of Zoan are become fools. The princes of Noph, the Memphis, are deceived. They've also seduced Egypt. They are the stay of the tribes. The two main upper leaders of Egyptians, of Zoan. The Eternal has mingled a perverse spirit in the midst thereof. There can't be any unity. There can't be any oneness. They've caused Egypt to err in every work thereof, as the drunken man staggers in his vomit. Neither shall there be any work for Egypt, which the head or tail branch or rush may do, in that day. Now notice again the time period. Dead giveaway. In that day, Egypt shall be likened to women. So their bravery and their pushiness of this day is going to turn. It'll be afraid and fear because of the shaking of the hand of the Eternal Host which he shakes over it. So when God allows those nations of Europe to come sweeping all the way down into North Africa. And then finally at Armageddon, they're going to be afraid and fear. And the land of Judah is going to be a terror unto Egypt. Well, you'd think that hadn't been true in our day? Little old bitty country of Jews with all those planes and weaponry and equipment they've gotten from America and France and England, and the land of Judah shall be a terror unto Egypt. Now that's why that war didn't last the 6 days. They just borrowed the equipment for a week, so. You know, they said next time they're going to get those Egyptians to make those tanks with backup lights on them, so. But how about God zeroing in on a description there? The land of Judah will be a terror to Egypt. Everyone that makes mention thereof shall be afraid in himself. Now that's more fulfilled in the future even than it has been in the past. Because you wait till God sets up the holy days and the people of Egypt aren't going to come. You already know that from Zechariah. So then they don't have any rain for a few years. Well, then they still don't come. Well, then plagues come on them. And then this verse will be fulfilled even greater. The land of Judah shall be a terror to Egypt. Everyone that makes mention of that Jewish God and that Jewish religion will be afraid in himself because of the counsel of the eternal of oaths which he's determined against it. In that day, five cities in the land of Egypt shall speak the language of Canaan. I haven't noticed all those Egyptian cities learning Yiddish yet, have you? No, you haven't. That isn't going to happen until in that day, though. Then the major cities of Egypt are going to speak Hebrew. They're going to swear to the eternal host. Now he's their God, too. One of those cities is going to be called, and there the Jews have deliberately mistranslated the word destruction, because that's a word they never applied to anybody but Jerusalem, the city of righteousness. But that's what the Hebrew word is there. The city of righteousness. Can you imagine a city in Egypt being called city of righteousness? Speaking Hebrew and practicing the religion of the Bible? In that day, there will be an altar to the eternal in the midst of the land of Egypt. That's not the Great Pyramid either. The Great Pyramid is not in the midst of the land of Egypt. And it's not an altar to the eternal. But Egyptologists think it is. They tell you those tunnels inside of there depicted everything in prophecy imaginable. You have to fudge a little bit on the measurements to make it come out right. But anyway, God says in the time of Christ's return and the beginning of the millennium, there will be an altar to the eternal in the midst of the land of Egypt. There's going to be a pillar at the border thereof to the eternal. It's going to be for a sign and for a witness to the eternal host in the land of Egypt. They're going to cry to the eternal when their oppressions come. And then God is going to hear them. And he's going to send them a Savior and a great one. Well, I don't know who that's going to be. Is that going to be Daniel or I don't know. But God is going to send them a Savior when they finally cry out to God in their distress and oppression. Then God will send them a Savior and a great one. And he'll deliver them, and there'll be the altar there, and they'll call on God and worship God. And the eternal shall be known to Egypt, and the Egyptians shall know the eternal in that day. Boy, that is a dead giveaway clause. The in that day can't happen until the Egyptians know the eternal, and he's known in Egypt. When they do sacrifice and oblation, when they vow a vow unto the eternal and perform it, that's when in that day is, and not until. And the eternal shall smite Egypt. Now you can read about the river. That hadn't happened to that river yet. But when in that day happens, that's going to have happened to that river. So here's another great chapter to show when that term in that day has to be. The eternal is going to smite Egypt, then he's going to smite and heal it. And then they're going to return to the eternal, and then he's going to be entreated of them, and he's going to heal them. Now look what's going to happen when God heals Egypt. They've always been one of the great nations on earth in the past. In that day, there shall be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria. And the Assyrian shall come into Egypt, and the Egyptian into Assyria. Now the way that's worded, you'd have to realize they're going to be bitter enemies right at the end of this life. And for God to show how much change happens, he's saying, hey, look the way it's going to be in the millennium. Boy, even Egypt and Assyria are going to have highways back and forth between themselves. Showing you how opposite that would be in our day. So we know what's going to happen when the king of the south pushes the king of the north. But the time's going to change, and there will be a highway out of Egypt to Assyria. And the Assyrian will come into Egypt, and the Egyptian will go up into Assyria. And that's going to be great, isn't it? When everybody's one and brotherly and together and united. And we can have Olympics where everybody is sports and brothers, teams. The Egyptians shall serve with the Assyrians. In that day, Israel shall be the third with Egypt and with Assyria. Now, God's not ranking them here and saying, okay, now this is going to be number one, this is going to be number two. Because if you notice, he switches the order in verse 23. He talks about Egypt to Assyria, and then he talks about Assyria to Egypt. So it's not one and two and three, but he's just saying they'll all be together. They'll be the three great leading powers toward the beginning of the millennium. Israel shall be the third with Egypt and with Assyria, a blessing in the midst of the land. Those countries are right in the center of the earth, and God's kingdom is going to begin to spread out through them and out from them, and those three are going to be a blessing in the midst of the land. Whom the Eternal of Hosts shall bless, saying, blessed be Egypt, my people, and blessed be Assyria, the work of my hands, and blessed be Israel, mine inheritance. But look at the terms he uses to describe the three. Egypt, my people, Assyria, God's built them and given them a great location in man's geopolitics, and they've been talented, so they've got their, God says, Assyria, the work of my hands. And then he says, Israel, mine inheritance. And all that means is they have been blessed to have known God from the past, to be living in God's territory. They're not any better than anybody else. They're not any greater than anybody else. Well, we'll pick up with chapter 20 next time. And we've got several short chapters, so we should be able to cover about 10 chapters next time. Pick up with chapter 20 then. Okay, Isaiah chapter 20. In the year that Tartan came unto Ashdod, when Sargon, the king of Assyria, sent him. Of course, the word Tartan is more a title like Caesar, or Ptolemy, or Antiochus. It's not a name of a literal king, but it just means supreme commander, chief of staff. It's an Assyrian military title. So Sargon, who was reigning at the time of Israel's captivity, he fought against Ashdod and took it. At the same time, the Eternal spake by Isaiah, the son of Amos, saying, go and loose the sackcloth from off your loins, and put off your shoe from your foot. And he did so, walking naked and barefooted. Of course, that doesn't mean naked in the sense that we might think of today as far as streakers, but this meant if all of the outer clothes were taken off, they'd walk naked and barefooted, like someone with just a loincloth on. This mentioned in Micah chapter 1 and verse 8, also in Amos 2 and verse 16. So if you want a couple of parallel scriptures, you might jot those in there with it. The Eternal said, like as my servant Isaiah has walked naked and barefooted 3 years for a sign and wonder upon Egypt and upon Ethiopia. So you might note how many of the countries in the Middle East are nailed down by name, and then by process of elimination, wonder which ones are left for the other names we don't know. So Egypt and Ethiopia are very plainly marked here. So shall the king of Assyria lead away the Egyptians, prisoners, and the Ethiopians, captives, young and old, naked and barefoot. So they likewise will be stripped down to just the briefest of garment. Now, of course, this doesn't just apply back in the historical days as far as fulfillment, that one of the keys of prophecy is the duality. So we know from Daniel 11, in the last days, the king of the north is going to go sweeping down through the Middle East, and Ethiopia won't escape, Egypt won't escape. So here again, this is dual, and it's going to happen again in our day. So the beast power, the king of Assyria,
is going to lead away the Egyptians, and that's probably a name that applies to a lot of Arabs and not just the one little territory of Egypt, and the Ethiopians captives, and they'll go naked and barefooted as Isaiah did as a sign against them, to the shame of Egypt, and they shall be afraid and ashamed of Ethiopia, their expectation. In other words, here he's talking again about how Judah depended on Egypt to spare them from Assyria when they came down and took them captive. Now, is that saying they're going to do that again in the future? That the Jews will lean on the Arabs around them to protect them against the Europeans? Or are they going to make treaties with the Europeans to protect them against the Arabs around them? Well, back in that day, Judah trusted in Ethiopia and Egypt to protect them against Assyria. So then Judah is going to be afraid. They hear as Judah, people of Judah, shall be afraid and ashamed of Ethiopia, their expectation, and Egypt, their glory, and the inhabitant of this coastland. Many times the word isles aren't literally what we understand them to mean today, but borderlands along the coast are sometimes referred to this way. So the inhabitant of the coastland of Palestine are going to say in that day. So all of a sudden that term brings you into the duality of the last day fulfillment of this. Behold, such is our expectation, whither we flee for help to be delivered from the king of Assyria. So here are the coastland countries of Palestine at the time the beast power comes marching down through the Middle East, and they're saying, where shall we flee for help to be delivered from the beast? How will we escape? Now, right after he talks about Assyria and what they do to Egypt and Ethiopia, according to Daniel 11, we know that after they take Egypt and Libya and Ethiopia are their next steps, troubles out of the northeast, rumors out of the northeast trouble them. And that's what chapter 21 is about. So all of a sudden you read about the Medes and the Persians and how they're going to sweep through like the winds off of the Negev, and how they're going to be a storm and trouble against this beast power that's now swept down through the Middle East and into North Africa. So now all of a sudden, the burden of the desert of the sea. In many cases, the Nile River, when it's flooded, is referred to as the sea. But here he's talking about a burden that's going to come against this beast power like winds out of the desert, as whirlwinds in the Negev pass through. So this power of the Europe, the Asiatics, the menace to Babylon, is going to come from the wilderness, from a terrible land, the Babylonian desert area and the Media-Persian power. A grievous vision is declared to me. The treacherous dealer deals treacherously, and the spoiler spoils. So as the beast powers going out in treachery, conquering and devastating, all of a sudden God unleashes the Asiatics, removes the angels that restrain them from east of the Euphrates. And all of a sudden God says, go up, O Persia, another name for Elam or Persia, besiege, O Media. So right at the key time, God takes down the fence and allows these 200 millions to go sweeping into the Middle East to put a stop to these Europeans taking over all the oil and the wealth of the Middle East. Go up, O Elam, besiege, O Media. All the sighing thereof I have made to cease. Therefore my loins are filled with pain. Now notice Isaiah's reaction of the fright of Armageddon. When he sees these 200 million come sweeping into the Middle East against these nations of Europe that have already taken Ethiopia and Egypt, then Isaiah says, my loins are filled with pain. Pangs have taken hold upon me, as the pangs of a woman that travaileth. I was bowed down at the hearing of it. I was dismayed at the seeing of it. My heart panted. Fearfulness affrighted me. The night of my pleasure. So all of a sudden, he was thinking about the good of the downfall of enemies, but then all of a sudden, human annihilation threatened. and the night of pleasure turned into fear. And now all of a sudden he says, prepare the table, watch in the watchtower, eat, drink, arise, you princes, anoint the shield. Which, of course, was a practice they did. 2 Samuel 1 and verse 21 is another example of that. If you want to jot that down, we won't turn and read it. 2 Samuel 1 and verse 21. For thus has the Lord said to me, go, set a watchman, let him declare what he sees. He saw a chariot with a couple of horsemen, a chariot of asses and a chariot of camels, and he hearkened diligently with much heed, and he cried, a lion, my Lord, I stand continually upon the watchtower in the daytime. So one of the powers that's going to meet there in this end-time battle at Armageddon is like a lion. And behold, here comes a chariot of men with a couple of horsemen, and he answered and said, Babylon is fallen. Of course, you remember that's quoted again back in Revelation 18 and verse 2. Jeremiah 51 and verse 8 is a parallel with that. Babylon, the golden cup in the Lord's hand, Babylon has suddenly fallen and destroyed. Jeremiah 51 and verse 8. All the graven images of her gods. And you notice when it talks about the power of Babylon, the power of Assyria, and notice here again, he interchangeably uses Assyria and Babylon. And of course, Assyria is just the leader of the last resurrection of that Babylonian power. And it's likened to a lion. So Babylon is fallen. And notice when Babylon falls, it's not atheistic power like Russia or China. When Babylon falls, it's a religious power. All the graven images of her gods he has broken to the ground. Now he refers to Israel in verse 10. O my threshing and the corn of my floor, that which I've heard of the eternal host, the God of Israel, I've declared to you. So here he'd seen how Israel had been threshed as the corn of God's floor, and then what happened to the world powers after that. And now he comes back to dwelling on some of the areas that made up the power, the burden of Duma. And of course, back in Genesis 25:14, it's an abbreviated form of the word Idumea. This abbreviated form just means silence. It's one of the sons of Ishmael. So here he's talking about some of the Arabs, some of the Ishmaelites. The burden of Duma, he calls to me out of Seir. Watchman, what of the night? Watchman, what of the night? In other words, how long is this darkness, how long is this black cloud of blackness going to stay? When will the light of the end of this war come? How long is this night of horror going to last? So small areas among the Arabs, this power is going to be spread out, and the war is going to be so widespread that even distant, scattered areas like Duma and like Dedanim down in verse 13, they're going to be affected. Even Kedar. So it's going to be spread out all over the Middle East. So now God is saying, well, you little remote areas, don't think you're going to escape all of it. It's going to be so widespread and so great, it's going to be a burden to all areas in the Middle East. Even small groups of Arabs, like Idumea or Duma, like Seir. The watchman said, the morning comes and also the night. If you'll inquire, you return, come. In other words, he's saying, there's no way of knowing for sure. If you want to ask me, but I can't give you an answer. The morning's going to come, he knows that. But he doesn't know how soon. The night is there. The burden upon Arabia, and you might jot back through and notice the number of burdens that are mentioned here. Now the burdens upon Arabia. Of course, skeptics get a big laugh out of verse 13, the forest in Arabia. And the word forest really is talking about thicket, where people in a remote, unsettled area are trying to hide out from this devastation that's going to come in the Middle East. So even in the thickets in Arabia, they're trying to lodge, hide out. O you traveling companies of Dedanim. So here again is another descendant of Ishmael. The inhabitants of the land of Tema brought water to him that was thirsty. They prevented or met with their bread him that fled. So here are people just flying from this Middle East world threat of annihilation, hiding out into the most desolate areas, the wastelands, and dwellers around there keeping them alive, bringing them water and bread. They fled from the swords, from the drawn sword, and from the bent bow, and from the grievousness of war. So there's more than just one sword. There's Asiatic hordes and European beast powers and the drawn sword and the bent bow. Thus says, has the Eternal said to me, within a year, according to the years of a hireling, and all the glory of Kedar shall fail. And the residue of the number of archers, the mighty men of the children of Kedar, shall be diminished. And you might jot down from the word archers here, Genesis 21 and verse 20. Because here again it shows how accurately the Bible ties together and how Isaiah always refers back to the books of Moses. Genesis 21 and verse 20. God was with the lad. He grew and dwelt in the wilderness and became an archer. So he was very famous and very accurate in that skill or ability. So even in Isaiah's time, they're noted for their archery. The residue of the number of archers, the mighty men of the children of Kedar, shall be diminished because the Eternal God of Israel has spoken it. So it just shows how widespread that war is going to reach and how no area will be left unaffected by it. Now you might notice in Ezekiel 27 and verse 20, another picture of the same time when all these various nations of the earth are all gathered together. Ezekiel 27, verse 2, he says, Son of man, take up a lamentation for Tyrus. O you that are situate at the entry of the sea, a merchant of the people, for many isles. Now you'll see this again in Isaiah in the next few chapters. Thus says the Lord Eternal, O Tyrus, you said I'm of perfect beauty. Of course, here he's talking about Babylon in the end time. But this time it's likened to another area of the old power of Rome. Your borders are in the midst of the seas. The inhabitants of Zidon, verse 8, were your mariners. Your wise men, O Tyrus, that were in you were your pilots. Verse 10, they of Persia and of Lud and of Put were in your army, your men of war. And then he talks about Tarshish was your merchant, verse 12. But a lot of the same countries are listed again here in Ezekiel 27. Back to Isaiah then. Chapter 22. The burden of the valley of vision. Now here again, if you start interpreting before you get into the chapter, you may come up with some guesses and they may not be accurate. So you have to be careful. You don't jump the gun and start interpreting before it tells you who it is. The burden of the valley of vision. Now, where is the valley of vision? Well, just read on. What ails you now that you're wholly gone up to the housetops? You're full of stirs, a tumultuous city, a joyous city. Your slave men, your slain men aren't slain with the sword nor dead in battle. All your rulers are fled together. Then in verse 4 he finally says, because of the spoiling of the daughter of my people. So there again you find out he's talking about Israel. He's talking about Jerusalem. In fact, a little later even zeroes right in and refers to Jerusalem and the house of David. And verse 8 says, he discovered the covering of Judah. So it shows again who he's talking about. And that's why you have to circle those key terms. City of David, verse 9. Houses of Jerusalem, verse 10. In that day, verse 12. So now you can know what it's talking about in that day, and about Jerusalem and Judah and the house of David and the city of David. So now when you back up to chapter, or the first verse, then you say, well, wait a minute, how can it be a valley of vision? Because Jerusalem, of course, is on a mountainside, and yet it's not really on the tops of the mountains. And when you're talking about symbolism and empires being mountains and kingdoms, then Jerusalem's not a big mountain. It's a fairly small country. Now, when you think about the Valley of Vision, here you're talking about the most solemn visions that have been seen. For example, Abraham's vision back in Genesis 22. Where was it? Well, it was right there on that little hip of Mount Moriah. Well, what about David back in 1 Chronicles 21? Where was that? Same place. What about Isaiah's many visions? Chapter 1 and verse 1 and chapter 6 verse 1. They're all right here on Mount Moriah, right out on the north side of Jerusalem. So here he's talking about the territory that you might not consider a valley in a normal sense. But here where all these visions have taken place, and in comparison to the other countries he's mentioned earlier, they are a small hill and a small mountain. So now he says, what's the matter with you that you're wholly gone up to the housetops? Of course, that's what they did during the feast time. You remember back in Matthew 24:17, where he said, he that's on the housetop, not let him come down to take anything out of there? Well, when did they dwell on their housetops? Well, at feast time. So apparently at a time when they should be mourning for the troubles that are coming, they ignore them and go right on partying and right on living it up and right on doing their utmost celebrating. So he says, you're wholly gone up to the housetops. It's so universal, nobody is down in the house. Everybody in the whole city is out up on their flat-topped houses celebrating. You that are full of stirs, and that's a poor translation, the word is outcries. You're full of warnings, of shoutings about calamity and troubles and punishment, and yet you're a tumultuous city, a joyous city. When is that? That's Jerusalem during feast time. Your slain men are not slain with a sword. Of course, in 70 A.D., they were starved. They weren't killed in the glory of a war. They were circled by the Romans and allowed to starve to death. Millions of them. So that's what he's saying happened to them. That may happen again. So there again, at a feast time, you know, they figured, well, the best time to catch all those Jews is at a feast season, because they'll all be in one city. They'll all be in Jerusalem, and then all you have to do is circle the city, and you don't have to chase them all over the country. You'll catch them all there in one mass, and just circle it and keep them there till they starve. And that's what they did. So instead of repenting and coming out in sackcloth and ashes, they were all merrymaking up on their housetops. All the people in the tumultuous city, a joyous city, all your rulers are fled together. So leave it up to the leaders, you know. They got out of there in time. They fled far off. Together, they are bound by the archers. All that are found in you are bound together, which have fled far away. In other words, you're all going to get caught and brought into oneness and a captivity. That's what he means, bound. Bound together. Whether you tried to flee and tried to escape, you're still going to get caught and put in a bind of a captivity. Or whether you stayed in the city, you're still going to get taken into a captivity. Therefore, Isaiah says, look away from me, I'll weep bitterly. Don't labor to comfort me because of the spoiling of the daughter of my people. So there again, the daughter of God's people. Not the mother back in the old day, but the end time daughter. So Isaiah's looking ahead to our day and in the future, when the daughter of God's people is going to be spoiled again. And a prophet shouldn't allow comfort when he realizes the calamity of what's going to happen. It's a day of trouble and of treading down. It's a day of perplexity by the Lord Eternal of Hosts in the Valley of Vision. Breaking down the walls and of crying to the mountains. In other words, crying out to the empires or the kingdoms to have mercy or spare, but they don't. And sure enough, as we read earlier, here are the Persians there. Elam bare the quiver with chariots of men and horsemen, and Kerr uncovered the shield. So you have a picture of Armageddon taking place. This term, daughter of my people, it's the only time it's used in Isaiah, but it's a very common word in the book of Jeremiah, also in the book of Lamentations. And yet Isaiah used it once, and yet mostly it's in those other books. It'll come to pass, your choicest valleys shall be full of chariots. And of course, if you've ever been to Jerusalem and Israel, you know the plains of Esdraelon around Megiddo are very, very rich country between Tel Aviv and Jerusalem and out in that country. Your choicest valleys shall be full of chariots. The horsemen shall set themselves in array. So here you have the gathering of the Asiatic hordes against the beast power, one termed horsemen and the other termed chariots in array at the gate. And he discovered or dismantled the covering of Judah. And you did look in that day to the armor of the house of the forest. And that's a terminology, the arsenal at Lebanon from Solomon's time on, a lot of their arsenal, their armor, they kept at Lebanon, the house of the forest, noted for their huge trees. So this power discovered that covering of Judah. You have seen also the breaches of the city of David. It wasn't hard to overthrow Jerusalem. There were many breaches by which you could get in and conquer. There are many. You gathered together the waters of the lower pool. In other words, they tried to get all their water into a cistern or a reservoir to withstand the siege. You have numbered the houses of Jerusalem, and the houses you've broken down to fortify the wall. So apparently they were just seeing how many people they could get to enter into the fight to try to spare Judah in the time of their fall. And then some houses they tried to use to make their city more fortified. You all made also a ditch between the two walls. In other words, you tried to hide some waters underground so nobody could starve you to death and cut you off without drink. But you have not looked unto the maker thereof. So they're trusting in their own ability, frantically, but they didn't look to God. They didn't depend on God. So apparently even in the end time, when Judah falls, they're not going to be depending on God and have God's help, but they're frantically striving to do all they can do humanly. You haven't looked to the maker thereof, neither had respect to him that fashioned it long ago. And in that day did the Lord Eternal of Hosts call to weeping and to mourning, and the baldness, and the girding with sackcloth. In other words, God warns you ahead of time that you should repent and mourn and weep and gird yourselves with sackcloth, but no, you were all partying on top of your houses. You're all wholly gone up to your housetops, celebrating music and revelry instead of repenting. So apparently we're going to have the job of warning them, and they were not going to listen. Behold, joy and gladness. Slaying oxen, killing sheep, eating flesh and drinking wine. And your proverbial attitude was, well, let's eat and drink because tomorrow we're going to die anyway. Might as well enjoy yourself right at the end before it's all over with. So instead of the people repenting and going through the things described, they just go right on with their revelry. It was revealed in mine ears by the Eternal of Hosts, surely this vanity is not going to be purged from you till you die. That's not a word of lawlessness there. The word is Avon in the Hebrew, says the Eternal Lord Eternal of Hosts. So there is no way they'd repent. They were warned. They were cried out against. Their land, as he said, was full of warnings, full of stirs, and yet they wouldn't hearken. So God finally settled the fact that only by death would their crooked nature ever be straightened out. Thus says the Lord Eternal of Hosts, go get you into this treasure even to Shebna, which is over the house. So here he comes to a picture back in 2 Kings chapter 18. Probably a foreigner or a heathen Jew was put in a position that should have been reserved for one of the priests. So now God is going to talk about getting rid of this person who shouldn't have been over God's house, that wasn't qualified, that they hadn't met the conditions. So now God says, go get you to this treasurer, even to Shebna, which is over the house, and say, what have you here? Whom have you here, that you hewed you out of sepulcher here, as he that hews him out of sepulcher on high, and that graves an habitation for himself in a rock? Behold, the Eternal will carry you away with a mighty captivity, and will surely cover you. So whoever this personage is going to be that's going to try to claim he has a right to be in a position in the temple or in God's priesthood or over the priesthood, at that time the man's name was Shebna. But apparently in the end time there's going to be somebody else, whether it'll be a high priest or whether it'll be just someone they caused to be the priest over an altar. But apparently God holds this them accountable for, instead of looking to God and asking God to put a person back in a position and restore their true worship, they take that into their hands and put someone like this man, a heathen Jew or a foreigner. But notice what it's going to end up being. Behold, the Eternal is going to carry you away with a mighty captivity. He'll surely violently turn and toss you like a ball into a large country. There you'll die, and there the chariots of your glory shall be the shame of your Lord's house. And I'll drive you from your office, from your station or administration, from your state. He'll put you down. And it'll come to pass, in that day, I'll call my servant. So here's Christ coming back to take the rightful position he has as the Melchizedek. And apparently the Jews are going to have somebody else in a position that is described here by this type of Shebna. But notice what's going to happen in that day. God's going to call his servant Eliakim, which means whom God sets up. And it's obviously the Christ. In fact, even the National Bible puts in the little P with a circle around it, showing they understand this is a prophecy about the Messiah. Well, go ahead and read. And I'll clothe him with your robe and strengthen him with your girdle. And that's a unique word as well, because that word is used only back in the law of Moses, Exodus 28, Exodus 29, Leviticus 8, Leviticus 16. You find this same term used, and it's not used other places. So here again, Isaiah takes you back to Moses' time and the laws, and the new Melchizedek priesthood, God is going to strengthen this new appointed one, this servant, with his girdle, and he'll commit your government into his hand, your administration. And he'll be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. And the key of the house of David I'll lay on his shoulder. Now, of course, he's one who was before David and one who descended from David. And so here he's talking about the Christ you see in Revelation with the key of David standing before the church of Philadelphia. So without any question here, he's talking about the restoration of Christ as the Melchizedek high priest in the kingdom. So he's going to take away the throne of David, the house of God, the mount of God, the administration, the office that this person has taken to himself. And it's going to happen in that day. He'll be a father to the inhabitants of Jerusalem and to the house of Judah. And the key of the house of David I'll lay upon his shoulder. So he shall open, and none shall shut, and he shall shut, and none shall open. And yet, how would you ever figure John would use that terminology to apply to the Philadelphian church? He took that right out of Isaiah 22, associates Christ with the Philadelphian church having the key of David, Says he unlocks and opens the door, no man can shut it, and shuts it, no man can open it. How does that all tie in with the Philadelphia church? But it does very plainly in Revelation 3. And of course, this key of opening and shutting is just a matter of the power of administration. The power of being in charge, the one with the keys, the one that unlocks the mysteries, the truths. I will fasten him as a nail in a sure place. He'll be for a glorious throne to his Father's house. So that's God's house, that's God's capital city, it's God's temple, it's God's work. So all of a sudden, like a nail in a sure place, Christ is going to be for a glorious throne to his Father's house. And they'll hang upon him all the glory of his Father's house. The offspring and the issue. In other words, he's the forerunner and the descendant of David. And finally, back on him are going to be all of the descendants, as well as the ancestors in the nation of Israel. All vessels of small quantity, from the vessels of cups, even to all the vessels of flagons. In other words, as you read in, what is it, Zechariah, that all the vessels in the temple will have holiness unto the eternal on them. So now they're given back to the one they rightfully belong to, the Melchizedek. In that day, says the eternal host, shall the nail that's fastened in the sure place be removed and cut down in fall, and the burden that was upon it shall be cut off. So now he's talking about this Shebna and how he was supposedly the nail of the house, the strength of the temple, and all of a sudden he's going to be taken away, and the real Melchizedek that qualified for that job will be put back in there. Now he goes to the burden of Tyre, so this parallels exactly what we read back there in Jeremiah. The burden of Tyre, howl, you ships of Tarshish, for it's laid waste. So there's no house, no entering in. From the land of Kittim it's revealed to them. Now here he's talking about the seacoast of Palestine, and yet they were some of the prominent territories during the time of the Roman Empire's strength. So here again he's really talking about Rome and the final Babylonian Empire, the burden of Tyre. Of course, back in the old days, the ships of Tarshish were probably the ships of Spain. And maybe in the end time, it may be talking about, again, the United States of Europe and one of the powers that make up a part of the United States of Europe. It's laid waste, so that there's no house, no entering in. From the land of Kittim, it's revealed to them. Of course, Kittim normally is the island of Cyprus, but all of a sudden, the word gets around in the Mediterranean that the seacoast of Tyre and Tarshish and Sidon are all laid waste. Be still, you inhabitants of the isle. You whom the merchants of Zidon that pass over and see have replenished. So here he's talking about the wealth of the Mediterranean, and Zidon is just another name for Sidon, Tyre and Sidon. And Cyprus there in the Mediterranean prospered from all of the merchandising of Tyre and Sidon. And you'll see later he ties it all in with Egypt and the wealth of Egypt. Notice verse 5, as at the report concerning Egypt, so shall they be sorely pained at the report of Tyre, because their trafficking and business was all, they all prospered together. But now all of a sudden, when Babylon falls and the Asiatic hordes come smashing into this Roman area, and all the news of their fall scatters around, then he says, howl, or be still, you inhabitants of the isle, you whom the merchants of Sidon that pass over the sea have replenished. And by great waters the seed of Sihor, the harvest of the river, is her revenue, and she is a mart of nations. And of course, here's another word that's used for the river shipping.
Let's see, there are other scriptures that...
Jeremiah 2, verse 18. And now what have you to do in the way of Egypt to drink the waters of Syre? Or what have you to do in the way of Assyria to drink the waters of the river? So here he's talking about the Nile River, the strength of Egypt, and the Euphrates and Tigris, the strengths of Assyria. So he's talking about the merchandising and shipping on the rivers and the ocean ways, the Mediterranean, the isles in the Mediterranean. The harvest of the river is just the merchandise that's traveled back and forth across the river. Okay, back in Isaiah once again. And verse 4, be you ashamed, O Zidon, for the sea has spoken, even the strength of the sea, saying, I travail not, nor bring forth children. In other words, there isn't any more prospering, no more merchandising, no more traveling and making wealthy all these areas around. I travail not nor bring forth children, neither do I nourish up young men nor bring up virgins. As at the report concerning Egypt, so shall they be sorely pained at the report of Tyre. So both areas are brought down, as we've read earlier. Pass you over to Tarshish, howl, you inhabitants of the isle. Is this your joyous city? Tyre, whose antiquity is of ancient days, her own feet shall carry her afar off to sojourn. And of course, the feet of Tyre was their shipping, her waterways, her ships. So by her own ships, she tried to flee and escape. Her own feet carried her afar off to sojourn, try to avoid this coming catastrophe of Armageddon. Who has taken this counsel against Tyre, the crowning city, whose merchants are princes, whose traffickers are the honorable of the earth? The Eternal of Hosts has purposed it to stain the pride of all glory and to bring into contempt all the honorable of the earth. In other words, the wealthy, the rich, the real powerful people who've built up this giant economy by all of their trafficking. Pass through your land as a river, O daughter of Tarshish. Now notice there, he's talking about the end-time descendant of that old mother area. And now all of a sudden, you can pass all the way through the land and there's no more strength. He stretched out his hand over the sea. He shook the kingdoms. So it's showing what God is doing to these world powers. He's stretching out his hand and shaking the kingdoms. The earth has given a commandment against the merchant city to destroy the strongholds thereof. So God is going to cause devastation to come on all these wealthy traders. He said, you'll no more rejoice, O you oppressed virgin, daughter of Zidon. So now here he's looking back to the daughter of Tarshish, the daughter of Zidon. Arise, pass over to Kittim or Cyprus. There also you'll have no rest. Not even in the land of the Chaldeans will you find any rest. And then he talks about this people was not the Assyrian founded it. In other words, the Assyrian are a fairly young people in comparison to the some of these other countries. So the Assyrian founded that area there in between the rivers. They set up the towers thereof. They raised up the palaces thereof, and he brought it to ruin. So God is bringing down these powers. How, you ships of Tarshish, for your strength is laid waste, and it'll come to pass in that day. So there again, it brings you down to the end time and shows you what God is going to do to these nations of the earth in that area that are really wealthy and influential. And it shall come to pass in that day, Tyre shall be forgotten 70 years, according to the days of one king. So it's just a normal lifespan of 70 years. After the end of 70 years, Tyre shall sing as an harlot. In other words, showing that even though God allowed punishment to be brought on Tyre for 70 years, they weren't corrected. They didn't change. They didn't look to God and repent and go the right way at all. So at the end of the 70 years, they turned right around and went right back to their same harlotry again. Take a harp, go about the city, you harlot that has been forgotten. Make sweet melody, sing many songs that you may be remembered. And it'll come to pass, after the end of those 70 years, the Eternal will visit Tyre, and she'll turn to her hire, and shall commit fornication with all the kingdoms of the world upon the face of the earth, and her merchandise and her hire shall be holiness to the Eternal. In other words, the wealth that the Babylonian Empire builds up in the last days, God is going to turn over to the Israelites, the Jews, to found the millennial financial system with. All of the merchandise and hire, and you find that in many scriptures, that God says the wealth accumulated by these nations combining together and with all of their trading, that merchandise and hire, God is going to take over. And he's going to use that to start establishing his kingdom in the beginning of the millennium. It'll not be treasured nor laid up. It's going to be used. It's going to be spent. It's going to be directed for restoring the earth. Her merchandise shall be for them that dwell before the Eternal. Her merchandise shall be to eat sufficiently and for durable clothing, for quality, for the foundation of the millennium. God is going to bring Israel back and halt this Armageddon threat of human destruction, and then he's going to take over all the wealth of all these world traders and use that to start restoring at the time of the millennium. Now, in chapter 24, you're really reading about the earth's conditions at the time of Christ's return. So if you want to see how bad it's going to get between now and the end, there's one little note in Sansino I might just read about the next four chapters, because he says, beginning with chapter 24 and going through chapter 27, these four chapters form a distinct group of oracles strongly marked by their general apocalyptic character. They speak of God's desolating judgment of the world, the terrors of that great day, the suppression of the power of evil in heaven and on earth, the consequent blessings upon Israel and humanity, the abolition of death forever, and the wiping away of tears from all faces. You know, that's not an Armstrongism. You can read the New Bible Commentary, and they recognize the same thing. And even Sansino, with all of their Hebrew and interlinear, recognize what these next four chapters picture. God's desolating judgment, the terrors of that great day, suppression of the power of evil, and then finally God's restored blessing, death abolished, and tears wiped away. Now in chapter 24, behold, the Eternal makes the earth empty. Now, the word ha-erez here, in the book of Isaiah, you'll find 16 times, which again is a good number. God revealing himself, 4 and 4, the number 16, or maybe God doubly revealing himself. And it's a good thing he does, because look at the conditions of the earth when he does. Behold, the Eternal makes the earth empty. Now, he doesn't really make it empty. It's said that way, if God doesn't intervene and stop it, if God allows it to happen, then it's as if God made it. God did it. And that's the way the Bible refers to things. You know, if God didn't protect Saul from an evil spirit, it said an evil spirit from God troubled Saul. Now, an evil spirit wasn't from God. But it was in the sense that he didn't have him hedged about and protect him anymore. But don't think God makes the earth empty. Man's doing that. You know, man made a bad mistake years ago, and he thought the earth was indestructible. You know, we thought there was so much water in the oceans it could never be polluted. We thought there was so much air and so much change of climate that you could never permanently foul up the atmosphere. You know, we thought the earth was so tough that you could build cities of 10 million people within a small radius and put that much weight on the earth's crust, it's indestructible. We're learning the hard way. It isn't any such thing. Can you imagine how much weight when you build a dam on a
a river and stack up water for miles and miles and miles, how much weight that puts on the earth's crust below it? Well, here's the way the earth's going to become before Christ comes back. The earth empty, makes it waste, turns it upside down. So really, when the apostles came and turned the world upside down, they were just turning it back right side up. We've already turned it upside down. Scatters abroad the inhabitants thereof. How did God do that? Well, by Armageddon. The inhabitants were scattered, fleeing from all these world powers threatening human extinction. It'll be as with the people, so with the priest. As with the servant, so with his master. In other words, all classes and ranks are going to be equally affected. You can't buy your way out of it. You can be as wealthy and powerful as you want, and it isn't going to get you anything. You're not going to avoid it. Now, these are exactly the same Hebrew words. You might jot down by verse 2, Hosea 4 and verse 9. Same exact words in the Hebrew. Hosea 4 and verse 9. Here's right after he says, verse 6, my people are destroyed for lack of knowledge. Because you've rejected knowledge, I'll reject you. You've forgotten the law, so I'll forget your children. Verse 8 is a unique verse. It talks about so much of the world. How many of the careers or professions in the world aren't eating up the sin of people? How much do lawyers eat up the sin of people? Divorce and remarriage, crookedness, fraud, slander, all kinds of things. What percentage? How about doctors, you know? Do they eat up the sin of people? Well, they sure do. They don't teach you to quit sinning so you won't have disease. They actually are fed by you living in your sin. And you stop and think what a percentage of the world's income is actually eating up the sin of people. If you stop people from sinning, what would you need? Would you need lawyers? Would you need hospitals? Would you need doctors? Would you need... What if nobody sinned? Well, that's a real unique little verse there. I think of that all the time, and I think about the judicial system, and I think about doctors and hospitals and mental institutions, and they eat up the sin of people. Now, verse 9, there shall be like people, like priests, and I'll punish them for their ways and reward them for their doing. So no matter who you are or how wealthy or how powerful, it isn't going to do any good in this coming day of calamity when this world is going to get in such a bad condition. It's going to happen to everybody, regardless of rank or wealth. So with his master, as with the mate, so with their mistress. As with the buyer, so with the seller. As with the lender, so with the borrower. As with the taker of usury, so with the giver of usury. So nobody's going to be spared one way or the other. And here again, the terms lender and borrower take you right back to the laws of Moses again. Same terms exactly as Exodus 22 and Deuteronomy 15. And okay, it goes on. The land shall be utterly emptied and utterly spoiled because the Eternal has spoken this word. The earth mourns and fades away. The oceans mourn and fade away. Trees, farmlands, mourn and fade away. The world languishes and fades away. The air to breathe and the water to drink and sail on. And the haughty people, now that's not very accurately translated here, it's talking about the height of the people, literally. In other words, the nobility, the higher class, the intellectual, the brainy, the powerful, they're going to languish just like anybody else. The earth also is defiled under the inhabitants thereof. They don't let the land rest, plow it over and over and over forever, and then irrigate, try to make up for their lack of letting land rest, cutting out all the trees and building dams and... The earth is defiled under the inhabitants thereof. We've corrupted the air and corrupted the water and because they've transgressed the laws. Because they've changed the statutes. That word ordinance is not ordinance in the Hebrew at all. it's the word C-H-O-Q, or statute, they've broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore, has the curse devoured the earth? Because man just totally transgressed God's laws. They that dwell therein are desolate. Therefore, the inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left. Burned with hydrogen bombs, atomic bombs, burned with the sun's heat multiplying manyfold over. Burned from what? The inhabitants of the earth are burned, and few men left. The new wine mourns, the vine languishes. All the merry-hearted do sigh. The mirth of Tabriz ceases. The noise of them that rejoice ends. The joy of the harp ceases. They'll not drink wine with a song. Strong drink shall be bitter to them that drink it. The city of confusion is broken down. Every house is shut up that no man may come in. There's a crying for wine in the streets, and all joy is darkened. The mirth of the land is gone. In the city is left desolation. The gates smitten with destruction. When thus it'll be in the midst of the land, among the people, there'll be as the shaking of an olive tree, and as the gleaning grapes when the vintage is done. In other words, God isn't going to allow human extinction, and man with all of his destructive weaponry is not going to put an end to everybody. It's going to be like the gleaning left in the earth. They'll lift up their voice, they'll sing for the majesty of the Eternal, they'll cry aloud from the sea, wherefore glorify you the Eternal. In the valleys, the name of the Eternal God of Israel, in the isles of the sea. So the only hope that there is for man's globe and earth is, as the name back here implied, God's going to intervene and restore the Melchizedek, and he's going to put an end to all this. Then they'll, you know, verse 14 and 15 are actually millennial verses. From the uttermost part of the earth, we've heard songs, glory to the righteous. But I said, my leanness, woe to me. So now he goes back to the old picture again of the Asiatic powers and the Europeans, because he says the treacherous dealers have dealt treacherously. Yea, the treacherous dealers have dealt very treacherously. So nobody can stop this continual movement toward world domination by nations of Europe and Asiatic hordes. No matter how frightening things might seem, the treacherous keep right on dealing treacherously, and the treacherous dealers even go into worse and deal very treacherously. So then there's the fear and the pit and the snare. Oh, inhabitants of the earth, that's about all there is on you. That's what's ahead. It'll come to pass. He who flees from the noise of the fear will fall into the pit. And he that comes up out of the midst of the pit will be taken in the snare. Because the windows from on high are open, and the foundations of the earth do shake. In other words, there's just going to be all kinds of uncontrollable volcanoes and hurricanes and tornadoes and all kinds of fearful sights in the heavens, and the windows from on high are open. You know, that's a term described when the flood came. The windows of the heavens were open. The windows from on high. You know, 2 years in a row over in West Texas, where they have about 11 inches of rain a year, they've had 21 inches in a day. 2 years in a row. So for some reason, the heavens just don't hold the rain normally like they should. And for some crazy reason, you know, you ought to study sometime about the heat of cities and what they do to cloud formations and how rains can be affected by the temperature going up from a city of 10 million. And, of course, all of a sudden, instead of clouds being able to scatter rain evenly, it just dumps it all in one place, and a little bit further away, there ain't any rain at all. The wind is from on high. Genesis 7, verse 11. You might want to turn back there and notice that, because in the 600th year of Noah's life, the second month, the 17th day of the month, the same day were all the fountains of the great deep broken up, and the windows of heaven were opened. Boy, that's God's promised he'll never destroy the earth with a flood universally again. But he's also prophesied that in one area there'll be mildew and in another area there'll be drought. But when you read about the windows of heaven being opened, that's kind of a frightening terminology. Well, coming back to Isaiah again, here he is just not feeling like eating and just fasting. And so he says, my leanness, woe to me. And then he goes back referring to the treacherous dealers dealing treacherously. You might want to jot down beside that Jeremiah 5, verse 11, because there again you find the same terminology that Isaiah uses back in Jeremiah. And of course we've seen it earlier here in Isaiah. Verse 19, the earth is utterly broken down. Jeremiah 4, verse 23. You have the great parallel between these two books. I beheld the earth, lo, it was without form and void, and the heavens, and they had no light. Jeremiah describing the same time period. And the earth is utterly broken down, the earth is clean dissolved, the earth is moved exceedingly. So apparently there's going to be enough of a earthquake that it's going to even have a final severe effect right at the time Christ intervenes, and the earth shall reel to and fro like a drunkard and shall be removed like a cottage. The transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it. War is a transgression, you know, that's sin. The transgression thereof shall be heavy upon it. And it's a sin to pollute the air and the water. It'll fall and not rise again. So God is going to have to intervene and supernaturally renew the earth. It'll come to pass in that day that the Eternal shall punish the host of the high ones. In other words, he's going to destroy those that destroy the earth. You might come back to Revelation 11 and notice how that ties in with what John says back here. Revelation 11. The seventh angel sounded the seventh trumpet, and the kingdoms of the world become the kingdoms of Christ, and he's going to intervene and start ruling. And of course, the 24 elders celebrate that. The nations are angry, though. Verse 18, the seven last plagues, God's wrath has come as a part of this seventh trumpet, the time of the dead, that they should be judged, not all the dead, but the dead that would be rewarded, the servants, the prophets, and the saints. Those who feared God's name, small and great. And notice, should destroy them which destroy the earth. So finally, God is going to have to just pour out seven last plagues to destroy people that are hell-bent on destroying the earth. So finally, God is going to destroy them that destroy the earth. And that's what he's saying here in Isaiah 24. In that day, the Eternal shall punish the host of the high ones. And that's what he was saying a little earlier, not talking about haughty, but he's talking about the top leaders of China and Japan and Germany and Russia and America and Britain and all these various world countries. To punish the host of the high ones that are on high and the kings of the earth upon the earth. And they'll be gathered together. Here's Armageddon. God will gather all nations there as prisoners are gathered in the pit, and they'll be shut up in the prison, and after many days, then they'll be visited. So God is gathering them at Megiddo, and then after a number of days, then he's going to pour out those plagues and just supernaturally put a halt to these people that are determined to destroy one another and bring their country's world dominion. And notice at the time when God gathers all these to punish them, the moon is confounded and the sun is ashamed. In other words, it's like they're not giving their light and they're like turned to blood because of the heavens. When the Eternal of Hosts shall reign in Mount Zion. There he's intervening. He's come back. He's taking over. So here again it shows the term, in that day, verse 21, is connected with Christ reigning in Mount Zion. So it shows you the time period of that term. And in Jerusalem, and before his ancients, Abraham, Isaac, Jacob, Noah, Abel, and Seth. So here he's reigning in Mount Zion, which is just a part of Jerusalem, before his ancients, gloriously.